Good morning, and welcome to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Buck, and Calvin Butenhoff coming to you live from our studio in downtown Waukesha. You can always join us, call or text at 855-752-4842. Leave a comment on the live stream if you are watching on Facebook, YouTube, and or Twitter. We have a jam-packed show coming up today. We really do. Carrie Williams from the Milwaukee County Zoo. She is the Conservation Research and Sustainability Coordinator, again, for the zoo. And she's going to join us at 10:33 to talk about there are renewed efforts now to weaken the Endangered Species Act.
Of course.
Yes. And so Carrie's going to join us to talk about why the Endangered Species Act is important, what it does for us, what it does for, we talk again about all the resources that we have here that we all love and would like to see conserved and protected. And we'll talk about the effects of the Endangered Species Act, what that does here in Wisconsin.
Yes.
As well as a broader look at that. So Carrie Williams from the Milwaukee County Zoo, joining us at 10:33. We have a little Beyond the Cheese episode in hour number two. The Delafield Brewhouse is celebrating its 25th anniversary.
I remember a time before.
I do, too.
I used to drive down 94 past the Smiley Barn and all
yep,
that stuff.
Yep.
You're southeastern Wisconsin. You know the Smiley Barn. And I remember one day they'd be like, oh, there's a brand new, it's a brew house.
And it's big.
It's huge. Yeah. And it feels, I went to a wedding there once. I just remembered that this morning. It's fancy.
Yeah, it is fancy. So Eric Knutson from the Delafield Brewhouse going to join us at 11:06 for a little Beyond the Cheese episode where we celebrate all things Wisconsin, even beyond the dairy industry, because we love our dairy too.
Mm-hmm.
And as he does every other Thursday at 11:33, talking all things sports with Journal Sentinel sports guru, J.R. Radcliffe. Coming up at 11:33, Big Bucks game tonight. Calvin will not be there, so we cannot count on the Calvin effect, making sure that the Bucks have another win.
Listen, Bucks, this is your last chance. Pick him up at the studio. Stretch limousine.
Take him.
You fly him to the airport. First class.
You need him.
6-star hotel.
Tonight, if you want to listen to the game, the Bucks at the Pacers, game 6, 5 p.m., and you can listen on locally grown radio, WFHR in Wisconsin Rapids. That is 97.5 FM, 1320 AM, or on WLAK, Lake Air, 1260 AM.
Where?
In Amory.
Amory.
My favorite place. I haven't been yet. Yet.
It's happening this year.
We're gonna make it up there.
We're gonna manifest it
and make it happen. All right. I wanted to start out, though. This happened just as our show was kind of wrapping up yesterday.
Yeah.
And this shooting outside of the Mount Horeb School, the only person injured was the gunman, who was a student.
Yeah.
That's what's being reported this morning. Apparently, some students were outside of the building when they noticed this 14-year-old with a gun, and some of them went inside and alerted teachers. And at that point, I believe that they do have a school resource officer there, and police were also called. So the gunman, as they put it yesterday, was neutralized. Fortunately, no one else was hurt. It could have been a much, much worse situation.
This person was 14 years old. Let's call it what it was. It was a child with a gun. When you say gunman, that conjures the idea of
an adult,
of a crazy person, all the things. This was a 14-year-old with a gun. And I'm sorry, but there's no such thing as a 14-year-old who goes to a school with a gun who isn't suffering from some kind of mental illness or something. And please, let's just call this was a child with a gun.
Aurora Powers was there. Her daughter, Ruby, because they were on lockdown for hours after this happened. Aurora Powers told a reporter she understands the challenges that students and teachers are facing. She quit teaching 2 years ago. The Uvalde Texas school shooting when 19 students and two teachers were slaughtered in 2022 is a big reason. Again, according to Aurora Powers, who was a teacher, she said the whole system needs to be reevaluated to put more focus on students' mental health.
Yes.
And we hear this all the time, tragically, when there is yet another shooting. It's never the guns.
Nope.
It's never access to guns. It's mental health. And yet, when it comes to fund these programs, the same people, it seems to me, who say guns aren't the problem. Let's fund mental health. When that actually comes, they don't fund mental health resources.
I was watching Instagram yesterday and a comedian came, and I promise you, I am not about to make light of this. She's a teacher and she's talking about the whole measure in Tennessee to give
armed teachers,
allow teachers to carry guns if they would like them. And she goes, I don't want you to give me a gun. I want you to give me pencils and markers and notebooks. I'm tired of, you know, like that idea of like the problem is right in front of us, and it is resources. It's money. It's assistance. It's a robust funding of our public education. Instead, they're like, we're going to slash your, we're going to take your funding. We're going to give it to school choice. And also if there's a problem, here's a gun. Good luck. Like, what are we doing?
Well,
right, and
we talk frequently, and we're going to continue that conversation in the next couple of weeks about how hard it is to recruit teachers. And it's always been a challenging profession. It takes a very special person to be a teacher.
I think it's a calling. For someone who loves it, it's a calling.
Absolutely. And not only do they have to be educators, they have to be social workers, they have to be nurses, they have to be psychologists, and now we expect them to be marksmen.
Yeah, they'd be cops. They have to be on the spot and go. They have to have the kind of training in a situation like that that like Green Beret, Special Forces, Navy SEALs have to make decisions on split second. Oh, and by the way, come with what would be 15, 20 years of arms training.
We had a listener call.
Yes.
The last time we talked about guns.
Yes.
And she was a firearms training. She trained people to handle firearms. She was also an educator.
Yeah.
And she talked about the fact that if you want to arm our teachers, then they better be having regular training updates.
Yeah.
Because even trained police forces are not 100% accurate when they fire.
Well, and that's, you know what, honestly, if we're talking public schools, just like the police, they are public employees. So I give them access to all the training, all the resources that the police have with regard to top firearms, good ammunition, all the training in the world, continuous education,
yes,
all that stuff. Not just, hey, if you want to carry a Glock, go ahead. Good luck. Also, good luck on the pop quiz.
855-752-4842. Leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and what used to be Twitter. Charles from Green Bay is on the line. Good morning, Charles. Thank you so much for joining us. What did you want to say?
Hey, guys. First of all, I was a teacher for 38 years.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have seen the changes. I appreciate it. I thank you very much. I have seen how this mess has changed and how people, pardon the expression, don't give a damn about, you know, doing anything about it because they want to make money on themselves through their political parties. But the fact of the matter is, I would never carry a gun in a school for one simple reason. A gun is powerful enough to go through a young child's body and kill someone who you don't want dead.
Yeah.
You kill one of your own students. How are you going to feel about that when you have to tell the parents, oh, it was my bullet that killed your child?
I thank you for bringing that up, Charles, because Greg and I have talked about this off the air many times about how awful would that be as a teacher to see one of your former students coming in and you're the one that has to shoot and kill them.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine, Charles, what it would be like to put in that situation.
Thanks for stopping.
I'll take a latte.
Charles at the drive-thru with a cookie. I'll take a cookie. Bill from Oconomowoc is joining us. Good morning, Bill. Thanks so much for listening. What's up?
Great topic as always. Republicans as a whole hate public education. They don't dislike it. They hate it. They want it destroyed. This is part of their plan. I don't care what they say. I'll debate any one of them. But on teachers carrying guns, it's coming out of Tennessee. What else came out of Tennessee? The replacement for Rush Limbaugh at noon. Clay Travis and Buck Sexton. These guys are beyond crazy. Tune in, listen to them. WISN. Listen to these guys. They're insane. Now, as far as instructors for teaching, I called one of the top instructors for concealed carry, and I had a discussion with her. And I said, how do you train for firefights? Honest to God, I am not lying. She said, oh, we don't fight fires.
What? That wasn't she wasn't kidding, Bill?
No, she was not kidding.
She thought when you brought up a firefight, how do we train teachers to handle the situation in a firefight? She actually thought you were talking about fighting a literal fire, not gunfire.
That's the level of some of these people you're dealing with. I carry more guns than one squad car every day. I could stop a small war. It doesn't even cross my mind. It's because I train hunting dogs, and I'm a guide, and I teach people how to shoot. So, but it's got nothing to do for people. It doesn't even cross my mind, ever. But yet these idiots that are running, even the concealed carry people, invite one on for a discussion. And I know you guys are very pleasant with opposition, but figure out what they know and ask them, how often should anybody who carries a sidearm, pistol, revolver, whatever you want to call it, or assault rifle, whatever, how often should they be trained? And if he says, well, they don't really need training, I said, you need more training in Wisconsin. You need 2 weeks of training to kill a deer. And you're telling me you don't need any training to kill a human.
I needed 2 years to become a barber.
You make a really great point, Bill, as always. Thank you so much for joining us. And I appreciate your compliment about us being, I hope we're gracious.
People who call with
adverse opinions.
Yes, we are.
I don't want to be argumentative. That's not the point. We don't get anywhere that way.
Jane doesn't want to be.
We're going to continue this conversation. I know I see you, Sharky and Paul. Please hang on the line. We will be right back. Stay with us. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, Calvin, all coming to you from our studio in downtown Waukesha. And you can always join the conversation at 855-752-4842 or leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. We are talking about the gunman who was killed outside of Mount Horeb Middle School yesterday. He was a district student. There are reports this morning that he was 14 years old. And just talking about the situation with guns in this country, Tennessee now is allowing teachers there to carry firearms. And we didn't even have a chance to mention this, which was horrific. The latest mass killing in the U.S. happened on Monday, April 29th, Charlotte, North Carolina. Four police officers fatally shot in the deadliest attack on U.S. law enforcement since 2016. Four other officers were wounded. They were trying to serve a warrant, I believe, and... four officers are now dead.
Those situations are some of the most dangerous. I mean, if you ask a police officer what the most dangerous call they're going to take, serving warrants and
domestic calls.
Really quick, in context of what Bill spoke about earlier before about training, I just want to tell a very quick story. I used to work for the city of Racine, and I talked to a lot of people there, especially police officers. We have a lot of them. And one of the people I would talk to a lot is the mayor's assistant, was the chief of police. And I just decided to ask him one day, I said, what are your thoughts on open carry? And he said, first of all, I don't even own a gun in my home. I don't think I need it. I have one at work. I have my methods of taking care of what I need to take care of. But he said, if people want to have guns, it's their absolute right to do that. But if they want to have a gun on them, they have to train like my officers have to train. They have to train. They have to go through testing once a year. They have to do continual education. They have to get themselves up to speed on what's going on with firearms and how to be the best practices. If people want to do that, then they can have guns. If not, this can't be these four-hour classes that your buddy's teaching in your backyard.
And you're done.
Because the training, quote-unquote training, is minimal at best and laughable at most.
Sharky from Racine has been waiting. Thank you for your patience. Sharky, thank you for joining us. What did you want to say?
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk here. From a standpoint of law enforcement, every law enforcement call should be deemed as an armed situation.
Yeah.
What I mean by that is the officer is carrying a gun, and that could go terribly wrong. In the early 80s, I was certified by the FBI for SWAT. And I thought that was pretty neat, and it was good training, until I got vetted by the FBI to travel to Tigerton Dells in 84 to eliminate or evict the posse comitatus. So I wasn't really excited about that. And the fact about this is that it went peacefully, and this was just sometime after Waco. So to use civilian officers trained by the military and the FBI. Now, as far as thinking about this situation, I have a three-year-old and I got a four-year-old child, grandchildren. This whole conversation, it's very hard to talk about it. My point is, though, in having this situation, and I think about what can I do now that I'm just getting, I'm 65 years old.
Yep.
What can I do? And I'm looking at every school structure, I'm thinking, what can we do better? Now, this might sound funny, but I tell you what, the FBI and the government building in Washington area, which is called the Pentagon. Now, that sounds silly, but, you know, obviously didn't stop an airplane. But if they could learn and see the structures and to ingress and outgress, and that could be part of it, where it shields this horrific stories we're hearing day in and day out.
Thank you, Sharky. Really appreciate it. And you do refer to something that we've talked about before, trying to remember when the last time we had to talk about this, but about making changes at schools.
Yeah.
As far as putting lots of bushes and hedges in front of windows so you can't see inside the windows. Mm-hmm. You can't see where people are in the building. So I think that's a legitimate suggestion. I don't know that alone is going to make everything safe, but certainly it's something to consider. Paul from Kenosha also has been waiting. Thank you for your patience, Paul. What did you want to say?
I am very worried about the potential unintended consequences of this, where it's not a question of when as much as it's a question. Yeah, it is a question of when it happens that, you know, Mrs. Jones got her gun stolen from her purse in her classroom, or Mr. Smith, his gun was in his briefcase.
Yep.
And a kid took it.
Yep.
And then, who gets sued? Is it just the teacher? Is it the school district? Is it the kid and his family? Like, you know, someone is going to get hurt or die over this, and they just rushed into it without really thinking this out well.
Yeah.
I agree with you, Paul, and we talk about that. We're just talking about this yesterday. As far as not looking further down the road on ramifications.
Yeah. Oh, yes. No consequences.
Really? Where is the forward thinking and taking this to end conclusions?
Yeah.
Instead of, this is what we're going to do. We're going to arm all teachers and that's going to fix it. Because that's I don't think that's the answer. Yeah.
Brendan Lewis on the live stream even said Tennessee even voted to against the teachers having to go through proper training.
What?
Not to mention the whole idea of it being bat, as he said, crap crazy. Because they want to make it quick and easy. And I wish we had more time.
We have a guest coming up after the 10:30 news, unfortunately. Thank you so much, Paul, for your call. Troy from Mount Horeb, we will try and get you in here real quickly. Thank you for joining us, Troy. What did you want to say?
Yeah, my wife could hear the shots from her house.
No kidding.
Imagine.
We're like three blocks away from the middle school, and it was just dumb luck that it wasn't a lot worse.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they talk about mental health, and they're not going to fund any of that. We had to pass a referendum to get fortified doors on the school, which helped stop this. So, you know, they're not funding any of that, so they can stop talking about it because it's ridiculous.
I feel like they, you know what, Troy, I feel like they got to say something. Yeah. So it's like, well, we'll just throw this out there. You know, we're not going to actually do it, but we'll imply that we're going to make some changes. And I agree with you. They just aren't. I'm so glad that you are okay and your wife is okay. Yes. And that no one, that this, as you said, Troy, it could have been so, so much worse.
Yeah.
It wasn't yesterday.
Yes. And just one last thing. Remember, he wasn't a gunman. He was a child.
He was a 14-year-old with a gun. News is coming up next. When we return, we're going to talk about the importance of the Endangered Species Act and what this helps protect here in Wisconsin. Stay close. You are listening to Matt Nair on Air, coming to you across the Civic Media Radio Network. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Box, Sweet Cal B, coming to you from our studio in downtown Waukesha. You can always join our conversation. You can call, you can text at 855-752-4842 or leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Very excited to have our next guest joining us on the phone. She is the Conservation Research and Sustainability Coordinator for the Milwaukee County Zoo. Carrie Williams is here. Good morning, Carrie. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We are delighted to have you. We've been wanting to talk about this for a while, especially because some of the things that just happened yesterday, a couple days ago. But first, Carrie, let's talk about the Endangered Species Act. Why is that important? What does it do for us, especially here in Wisconsin?
Sure. So the Endangered Species Act, it was passed in 1973, so we just celebrated the 50th anniversary of it. It's a piece of federal legislation that provides a way and a mandate for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to identify species that are considered to be threatened of or in danger of extinction, and then the ability to mandate and lead research and protections for those species that have been identified. So that's like ESA, you know, is held by U.S. Fish and Wildlife, but it's also overseen in conjunction with some other federal agencies. And it provides that way. It was kind of the it was a piece of legislation in a series of legislation that kind of really started happening in the earliest part of the 20th century, starting with the Lacey Act in 1900, the migratory bird treaties, which were signed and went into effect to protect those birds that had those beautiful plumes that were becoming endangered because people were hunting them.
For the hats, for hats, right? Carrie, yep. they were killing all these birds so women could put feathers in their heads.
Yeah, absolutely. And so making those transitions from allowing things like market hunting, so being able to harvest wildlife and then sell it for a profit, that kind of the initial pieces, you know, first the Lacey Act, then the Neotropical Migratory Bird Act, A specific one that passed in 1940, the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. And then in the 60s, there were two kind of precursors to the Endangered Species Act. One was the Endangered Species Preservation Act, and then next was the Endangered Species Conservation Act. And then those pieces of legislation started to kind of talk about, you know, we're going to list these species, we're going to have a sense of what is becoming threatened and why it's becoming threatened. And that happened a lot in alignment with kind of a lot of what we saw in the 1960s, awareness of the impacts of some of the sources of endangerment, which, you know, real broadly can be looked at as loss of habitat, invasive species, contaminants and pesticides, over-harvesting, and then kind of human-related threats, whether that's population change or climate change. So, in that time period, in the 1960s, there was kind of a spike in understanding about and a desire for movement towards being able to kind of reverse and or address these things when we saw them. And so the Endangered Species Act was passed in 1973. It almost passed unanimously, which was huge when you think about legislation.
Seriously.
Yeah, it at the time, you know, it passed unanimously in the Senate, and I think there was, like, I don't want to misquote, but I feel like the no votes in the House were maybe less than a dozen or so.
Wow.
And when you when you think about current legislation and how very often legislation passes by much more narrow margins, it was kind of a very universally supported mandate to say we need to take action and we need to provide a way for the federal government to do that.
Carrie, look, one of the things I want to do is I want to read a really quick quote here, and it says, "Nothing is more priceless and worthy of preservation than the rich array of animal life with which our country has been blessed." That was President Richard Nixon who signed that into law. And when you're talking about legislation passing almost unanimously and, you know, all the bickering we do nowadays, it's amazing to see back and see 50 years ago, two parties, one president unite to say, yes, this is worthy. This is important. We need to save these animals and help them because it has benefits. And I mean, it says in an article that I read, it said that, like, and if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, it said, of the animals that are listed, 99% of them were saved. They were helped, and they're either no longer on the list or they're very much higher up on the list, so they're not as much worry.
I think when it can be really hard when we're talking about something like species conservation, because we want to really talk about these broad numbers to say, you know, X number of species have been helped. And I can't, like, verify or counter that number because I don't have it. I'm not an expert.
At your fingertips. Sure. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. But what I will say is that, there's kind of a twofold thought about when we're doing, species conservation is that, we may have overarching successes, and there are many, and then that can be pointed to as being the outcome of this legislation in conjunction with state agencies, in conjunction with tribal nations, in conjunction with private NGOs, and in conjunction with a lot of zoos and aquariums as well. But there's always that, just kind of that thought that you species conservation, if you're a species that wasn't able to be conserved, that's your everything, right? So it does feel, wildlife conservation is one of those things that can feel like this overarching uphill battle. And I think it is because the threats do continue.
Yes.
So it does require onward action and vigilance to continue identifying, addressing, and assessing threats. And then making sure, you know, a fundamental piece of conservation is the recognition that there's a lot of messaging in conservation that may, whether it's intentional or not, tends to point at specific people as the source of the problem, and people are, you know, very often they're the contributors to the problem, but people are also always the solution. You'll never get a conservation solution that happens without getting people behind it to take action.
Yeah.
And so we have to make sure, you know, that's a huge part of what we know and what we want to do is be sure that the action that we're taking, it's supporting and in conjunction with the people that live in the areas that are surrounded by it, and then identifying what are the impacts of those actions and, you know, are they necessary impacts? Can they be mitigated? And how do we best take the action to support the CCs, which is the mandate under the ESA, in a way that provides for the continuation of that species?
If you're just joining us, Carrie Williams is our guest. She is with the Milwaukee County Zoo, and she is the Conservation Research and Sustainability Coordinator. And we're talking about the importance of the Endangered Species Act. And I have to say, Carrie, when you were talking about the origin and Greg mentioned Richard Nixon signing this, and then I was thinking about Earth Day. For people, for younger folks, and even for people my age, I think we forget pollution was really bad in the 60s and 70s. I mean, water pollution, air pollution, all of those things. And I think this is all a piece of that. It seems like we all started becoming aware of how all of this is intertwined. You know, our wildlife, our animals, it's all part of a piece. It's all part of the thing, right, Carrie? I mean, I think some people can be a little cavalier and go, oh, we lost, you know, the brown-toed newt and it's going to be fine. But the brown-toed newt has a place in the whole cycle, correct?
Right, and I think exactly as you're kind of alluding that those thoughts about ecosystem conservation as a whole. I mean, we humans are part of the ecosystems in which we live, and we're more broadly we have broader ranges than any other species on the planet. Right, we're everywhere, and so. But there's also that piece that you need to kind of consider it systemically. So it's the overall health of the landscape. You know, are all of the pieces in the landscape that need to serve all those landscape functions, are they all there? And I think it's not an important piece to consider as well is that it doesn't only happen in one way. With some of the ecosystem changes that scientists are documenting over time, we're seeing ranges shift. And those ranges shift, that could be everything from, you know, a tiny insect that lives somewhere and, you know, maybe it's a tick that was never seen in a certain area and now it's being documented in that area because of shifts that are occurring in the plant structures in that area or the overall climate in that area. You know, those kinds of things happen. And it happens the other way as well. You know, we all got very excited last year in the state of Wisconsin when we documented flamingos here for the first
time. Yes, we talked about that. Yes.
Yeah, everybody did, right?
Yep.
And there was a series of sightings in states where they had never been seen before because they had been blown off course, presumably, by some of the recent storms that had occurred. And so, yes, ranges constrict and habitats need to be preserved, absolutely, and that's what we're working towards, and that's what I would hope most of your listeners are finding ways to work towards as well. But we also see shifts of animals that their ranges may expand. And I'm probably going down a huge rabbit hole here, but the point of that just being that, as you noted, you know, thinking about the ecosystem as a whole, thinking about the things that are going into it, thinking about the things that humans are relying that are part of it, but also thinking about the wildlife that's a part of it, and are there roles that that animal is serving in that habitat, in that biome? Are there things that that animal is doing that, if that animal is gone, won't happen anymore? And obviously I work at a zoo, so I'm focused on animals, but it's not just animals. It's also things like microorganisms. It's things like fungi. It's definitely plants as well. So it's that piece of that understanding, which, as you noted, kind of, it grew a lot during the 1960s as a result of the movements that were occurring that time, and humans seeing the changes that they were seeing in their lifetimes and raising those questions.
I guess the one thing, Gary, that jumps out to me was that the Cuyahoga River in Ohio caught on fire because it was so polluted. Mm-hmm. And it was things like that, I think, that really made people sit up and go, this seems bad.
Yeah, all those things leading to things like the Clean Air Act and the Environmental Protection Agency and some of those other pieces, that those pieces of federal legislation. And I should say, you know, I'm not an expert on federal legislation, if anybody has.
Us either, Carrie. Us either.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Entire careers are made on interpreting, on legally interpreting one single piece of federal legislation, and I am not a person with that career, so I should make that disclaimer there.
Absolutely.
So also, you are not lawyer and professor of constitutional and federal law. Okay, good to know, Carrie.
Not a problem, Carrie. We have a very quick pause coming up, and then when we return, we can talk more about what the zoo does to encourage sustainability and conservation. And we have one of the best zoos in the country. We really, really do.
I really agree.
We do. Carrie Williams is here with the Milwaukee.
I will not argue with
you. Grace, we'll talk more about that and sing your praises on the other side. Stay close. You are listening to Matt Nair on Air. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, Dr. Slide on the board. We're coming to you from our studio in downtown Waukesha. You can always call or text at 855-752-4842. Leave a comment on the live stream if you're watching on Facebook, YouTube, or the platform that Elon continues to ruin. We are very excited to have our guest on the phone with us. Carrie Williams is with the Milwaukee County Zoo. She is the Conservation Research and Sustainability Coordinator, and just talking about the Endangered Species Act, why it's important, why we still need it, what it does for, I mean, not just the world, but Wisconsin in particular.
And the articles that we referred to as far as, you know, the interview, I will put them on the show notes so you can read them after the show, which you're listening to as a podcast. So follow along.
Follow along. Carrie, let us sing the praises of our wonderful Milwaukee County Zoo.
Just I love the penguins!
Just for a little bit, because there's a lot going on at the zoo, and there have been so many changes. I can remember going when Samson the gorilla was still alive in that horrible teeny tiny enclosure, and it's just that the zoo is, it's so beautiful now, and the whole attitude is just so much different than it was in the 60s.
Oh, certainly. And I would agree. I think I almost feel as though internally we could make a bet on if you're going to do an interview, whether or not someone is going to mention Samson, just by the way. Samson, one of our famous former residents. Yep. And I think that one of the things that comes out of one of the references you just made is just how zoos and aquariums over time, you know, our everything has shifted, our standards, our expectations. Basically, as we continue through research to learn more about animals and their needs, we shift our standards and our habitats to reflect those needs. And so, you know, the flip side of the reference that you just made is just the difference between how Samson was housed at that time, and the front of house spaces and the back of house spaces that our gorillas have access to now. And that kind of, it's an ongoing progression here at the zoo. And so longtime area residents, you know, they might come, and if they join us right now, one of the very first things that you see when you come in our main entrance is a big construction site, because our Humboldt Hemingun habitat, which is just inside the zoo's main entrance there, that's undergoing some changes right now. We're making upgrades to the pool and the life support and some other things with that habitat. And that's an ongoing process for us. I know sometimes I have had guests at times make comments or questions about the length of a project, and I always like to remind people that our facilities don't necessarily just house humans. They need to be able to house and be designed for and support the biological needs and the well-being of the animals that we house. And sometimes those are big changes back of house that aren't as visible as they are, but then a lot of times there's also really great changes front of house. So we're always excited to have project happening, because of, you know, our teams, we have input on what it is that we are doing so that we can make sure that we're you know, meeting and surpassing those modern standards that we want to have to ensure our animal well-being here at the zoo. But you're right, it is a very different place than it was when I was young. I grew up in the area as well, and so this is my home zoo. So
no, that's great. That's wonderful. I've done work with the Milwaukee County Zoo, Carrie, for many years. Jenny Deliberti was there for decades,
yeah.
and it's just always been such a pleasure to see all of the changes. And just so you know, Matt Nair on Air is a very pro penguin show. So if you ever need someone to, you know, come out on behalf of penguins, we're the people for you. And like you two talked about, the front of the house is one thing, but all of the things in the background make an enormous difference for the health and welfare of these animals. And I'm thinking about the really impressive new elephant display, where they have so much more room now. And I also love, and I don't know how long this has been in effect, but they give animals toys now to keep them stimulated. And I just think that is great.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and so that's a process that we call enrichment. And really what we're doing there, sometimes what we provide does, it may resemble or look like a toy. And really what we're doing is providing something that encourages an animal to use their natural behaviors. So whether that means taking... it might mean something where an animal has to manipulate something. One of my favorite examples is that at times we will take, there's a post that are used for big cats, and so something may be mounted at the top of that. It might be part of their whole prey diet or something. And so a lion, if you time it right, you'll be there. You'll be able to see them kind of climb up, take what they want from the top, and then jump down. And so kind of the movement that an animal would normally engage in to do some of these things, providing those opportunities for animals to express their natural species-specific behaviors. And sometimes the things that are used to do this, they may be something that is used by human. It may be a human toy, but a lot of times they're not. And sometimes it doesn't look like what you would expect it to look like.
Right.
Sometimes it might be something like streamers in a habitat, than an animal that has the ability to manipulate things to go through and move those streamers and pull them down. It's a change in the habitat that they can react to. But a lot of times it might be something else. It might be for a predator. It might be bedding from a prey animal that allows them to kind of smell those smells and work with them and things like that. Absolutely. We do a lot of it.
We got just a couple of minutes left, Carrie, and I didn't mean to imply that you're teaching them to do crossword puzzles or something. I think that
that would be amazing.
No, that's not what they do. Carrie, how can people?
Yeah, absolutely not. And I'm sorry if my response made you think that.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, go ahead.
How can people get involved and learn more about conservation and how it's important and what we can all do to save and protect the things we all love?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the easiest things that people don't necessarily even think about is visiting AZA-accredited zoos and aquariums. And for people who aren't familiar with what AZA is, it's the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. It's an accreditation organization, which means you can't just join it and say, I'm a member of it. They go through an accreditation process where you, once every 5 years, you submit this really big application where you go through all of your operations, you provide documentation on how you're meeting those gold standards for animal care and welfare, and then they come on your site and they do an inspection. And just for a scope of thought on that, there are lots of places that have what is called a USDA exhibitor's license, and about 10 to 11% of the facilities in the United States that have an exhibitor's license are also AZA accredited.
Carrie, I'm so sorry to cut you off. We are coming right up against the news. My apologies. Carrie Williams is with the Milwaukee County Zoo. She's the conservation research and sustainability coordinator. We'll get a link up to the Milwaukee County Zoo in our show notes. Carrie Williams, thank you so much for joining us. Stay close. News is next on the Civic Media Radio Network.